This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Ever sat down at a wobbly table? If you're adventurous, maybe you folded up some napkins, tried sticking them under that particular table leg that was causing all the problems. Didn't work. Still wobbly. So you sit back, grit your teeth, and try extra hard not to spill your soup. This hour's guest, we hear he's not so good at sitting back and gritting his teeth. In fact, he got so fed up with wobbly tables, he went and invented a new kind of substance you could easily carry with you that could tame a table anywhere, no problem. And this new substance may have hundreds of other uses as well. Getting the idea that physicist Lou Bloomfield is an interesting guy? Stay tuned. Your chance to talk with the author of How Everything Works is coming up right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Did you take physics in school? How'd that work out for you? Did you find that you absolutely loved the subject, or not really so much? Did it occur to you that there might be ways to make the science of physics more interesting, more approachable, even easier to understand? Well, over the past two decades, this hour's guest has given much thought to those questions and has come up with answers you just might find absolutely fascinating. And if you do have answers of your own or even questions about anything to do with the world of science, you are invited to join in at 888-WMRA-TALK. We are coming to you today from the studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities in Charlottesville, but our call-in number is the same as always, 888-967-2825. Physicist, teacher, inventor, education reformer, and author, Lou Bloomfield is our guest. Dr. Bloomfield, thank you so very much for making time for us.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Tom.
Lou, if I could start with this basic question, what is it about the science of physics that you would like most everybody to know?
Well, to start with, it's really useful. I view physics as kind of the user's manual or the user's issue for our physical world. If you understand finally how things work at the level of physics, you have a lot of tools to work with then to solve your everyday problems.
And yet, your view also is that most people, when they hear the word physics, experience what?
Fear, trepidation, it's too bad. Somehow, a lot of physics education and maybe science in general, it isn't really relevant fun. It's often done in sort of an academic, abstract environment fashion, so that it just drifts off into la la land, and it becomes kind of a hazing ritual or a rite of passage for a lot of people. They don't appreciate it for what it is. It's actually really useful stuff.
Give me an example.
Oh boy, roller coaster. You go on a roller coaster. Probably most people have done this. And say a roller coaster loop-the-loop. Now, if you can remember doing this, when you're on the top of that loop-the-loop and traveling very fast around in a circle, if you closed your eyes, you couldn't tell you were upside down. You actually feel pressed into your seat, even though it's inverted, as though the sky were pulling you upward. And well, the reasons for that are relatively simple physics. It's doable. You can figure this out and understand it. And in doing so, you have a sense for why you're pressing your seat there and why you're not so pressed into your seat when they simply hang you upside down, as some roller coasters do. They don't whip you around in a circle very fast. They just sort of hang you upside down. And the reason this is all useful is because suppose you want to collect the change that's going to be falling out of all the people's pockets. Don't stand underneath the conventional loop-the-loop. Nobody's going to lose any change there. It's going to be pressed into their pockets just like normal. What you want to do is hang out underneath those areas in the roller coaster where they just hang the people upside down. That's going to be where all the change falls out. The sunglasses come off. The hats go over. So there, physics then is useful. It's if you want to make money, you know where to go.
So explain to us, if you can, why when I'm upside down as a result of acceleration, is that part of the factor?
It's part of it, yeah.
That the change is not going to fall out of my pocket.
Well, it starts with inertia. The notion that an object at rest stays at rest, or an object in motion continues in motion. And we've all, I mean, most people have heard that sort of remark, but we don't really take it to heart until we stare at it for a while. What it says is that when something is moving and you leave it alone, it keeps moving. It doesn't stop, as intuition says it will do. If it's truly on its own, it will go dead straight at a steady speed. Well, once you've sort of dug into that notion long enough and you start to realize, boy, if you get rid of friction, get rid of air resistance, and just let something go, it really will go straight. And you look at the roller coaster loop, you realize, well, that's not straight. That roller coaster track is going to bend the path of its riders into a circle or pretty close. So they're not just inertial. They're not following inertia. Something must be pushing on them. They're not being left alone. And sure enough, the track is pushing them. It's pushing them to bend their path into a circle, and that the push that the track needs to exert on the car and the riders is pretty much toward the center of that circle. That's the right direction to push them to bend what would be normally a straight path into a circle path. Well, that means that at the top of the roller coaster loop-to-loop, where the car's upside down, people upside down, the track is pushing down on the people, on the car, and the car is pushing down on the people to bend them around into a non-straight path. If the track is pushing the car down and the car is pushing the people down, it turns out that the people push up on the car, they push back on the car pushes back on the track. That's the action-reaction law that you've heard tell about, that if you push on something, it pushes back. Well, that's true. So if the track pushes on the car pushes on the track. Basically, everybody's pressed against each other. You are pressed against your car, even though it's above you. And the car is pressed against the track, even though it's above the car. Now, gravity's involved, but gravity is sort of plays a bit role in this story. You're going so fast that gravity alone just doesn't do much in this context. The track has to shove you downward to bend you. And that means that you and the car are pressed tightly against each other. You're not going to come out of that car. You're stuck there. You don't need the safety gadgetry, although the lawyers obviously want that in place. And all the things in your pocket, your pocket's bending those things around in a circle too, and they're pressed into your pocket. They're not coming out, so no change comes out of your pocket. So it's the battle between the track trying to bend your inertial path and inertia trying to make you go straight.
His book is titled, his book for the lay public, as opposed to his other books for college students. His book for the lay public is titled How Everything Works, Making Physics Out of the Ordinary. Lou Bloomfield, author of that book, is our guest. If you want to talk to him, we've got a phone line open at 888-WMRA-TALK. Lou, How Everything Works is a pretty all-encompassing title. What do you most hope somebody's going to get out of reading this book?
I think of the book as sort of the user's manual for the world. That here's all this stuff that we use all the time, whether it's an automobile, an airplane, a hot air balloon. I think of all these things to take you somewhere. What else? Light bulbs. Radio. We use all these things, and I can explain for pretty much anybody how each of those things work. And once you know how they work, you can make better use of them. You can fix them if they break. You can design your own. It gives you a lot of freedom to do things that would otherwise just sort of be magic to you, indistinguishable from magic. The world isn't magic. The world has rules that govern how all these things happen. And if you know those rules, you're suddenly able to sort of take charge. And I view the whole act of teaching physics as unmagic. My goal is the opposite of what a magician's goal is. A magician's goal is to sort of baffle you and obscure the truth and play games with you. I'm trying to give away all the secrets, every last one of them. And it's not about me trying to be the grand poobah who knows everything and you just the little peon who doesn't. I'm really just trying to give it all away because it's of no value to me to just hang on to it. I mean, of course, I like using the stuff, but the more I can give to other people, the more successful this whole thing is.
You got into teaching, though, almost by accident, didn't you? I mean, you got a PhD in physics because you were fascinated by how things worked, and you loved doing research. And in fact, your last couple of years as a pure researcher, I think this was back in the 1980s. Was it Bell Labs?
That's right. Yeah.
And then you needed a job, so you came to the University of Virginia, and although you were focused on doing research, you also had to teach, and something happened.
Yeah. Yeah, at Bell Labs, we just did research, and it was the end of the heyday of Bell Laboratories when the phone system was breaking up for legal reasons, and it was clear that Bell Labs was not going to be what it was. So I went to a university, and the standard party line of people at Bell Labs was, oh, yeah, no, we'll go to the university, and we'll do our research, and, well, we'll just suffer through with the teaching. It's a little nuisance you have to do. But actually, I liked the teaching. I found it really fascinating and rewarding. And I started off teaching relatively high-level classes, and that was great. And eventually, for very complicated reasons, I was actually chair of the teaching committee in physics at the time. I decided I would try teaching what I love the most myself, which is how things work. So I created the course. It turns out other people have invented the same course in the past. So I reinvented it, but I'm probably the one who stuck with it the longest. And I started teaching non-scientists how the world works. And, you know, it's really my mission in life. I stumbled on it, not exactly by accident, but pretty close. And it's a great thing to do. I have the privilege of taking people who know very little science, even having taken a year or so of high school physics. They know very little physics in any case when they come in the door, and they go out knowing a pretty decent swath of it. It's a big change. It changes their worldview significantly. And wow, how many people get to do that with a lot of people, with a lot of students?
And yet, having been a teacher for more than 20 years now, there are ways in which the process of teaching, or at least the institution of teaching, does not please you.
Yeah, the institution of it. It's tough because the rewards for teaching these days are get fewer and thinner. It's no one really wants to pay for teaching. So research universities really continue to reward the research as though they were Bell Laboratories. And the teaching, to an extent, comes along for the ride with relatively weak support. And that's a problem. I wish things were different. I'm not sure how to change them.
Well, you've experimented some recently with teaching this new thing, sometimes referred to as a MOOC,
yeah,
a massive online, massively open online course. So we're going to hit the break in a moment, and I do want to ask you about that. I also want to say to anyone who's listening, well, ask you this question. Do you recall what science courses you took in school and whether physics was among them? And if you have any ideas on how to get young people interested in physics in particular, or science in general, we'd love to hear your thoughts at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Or you can post to us on the Virginia Insight Facebook page. Anything you want to talk about relative to science and physics, we'd be happy to hear from you. And we're going to be speaking with Lauren when we get back from the break.
Science is real.
From the group They Might Be Giants and their 2009 album, Here Comes Science, the song Science is Real, Science is Our Focus. This hour, our guest, Lou Bloomfield, author, inventor, education reformer, and professor of physics at the University of Virginia. We are going to somewhere on Interstate 81 to a gentleman who's pulled off safely from the highway. Lauren, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment for Dr. Bloomfield, please.
Hi, I live in Lansing, Michigan. I drive truck over the road, currently near Staunton, Virginia. Anyway, granddaughter's high school graduation open house late in the evening. The ice is all pretty much melted out of the big tub of cans of soda. There's diets pretty much floating on view. I'm sitting in the back porch with the adults drinking a cold Pepsi. One of her classmates, a senior, I don't know if he's taking physics or not, I did, he says, where'd you get that regular Pepsi? All I found was diet. I says, sugar is denser than water, therefore it's heavier. You aren't going to find it on the surface. His eyes lit up. He went back, disappeared with a new agenda, and when he came back with a very cold hand, but a Pepsi.
That's great. That, you know, You got the science right. The sugar soda is denser. When you dissolve sugar in water, you end up with a liquid that's a little denser than normal water. That is, it's got more mass in the same volume, and it's got more weight in the same volume. And things float when they are less dense than water, and they sink if they're more dense than water. So the can of sugar soda, filled as it is with a dense liquid, goes right to the bottom. On the other hand, diet sodas are essentially water, I mean, with a tiny bit of chemicals in there, and all they need is a little gas open space, which they have, and they perk right there up there at the surface of the water.
Lauren, thank you so much for teaching many of us something we did not know and how to look for the real sugar stuff the next time we're sorting through a cooler. Something that you may not know, and I'm sure you run into this all the time as you travel all over the country, that city names are sometimes not pronounced the way you would think. So actually, the name of the city that you just passed, although it's spelled Staunton, is pronounced Stanton. Now,
well, when I was in, when I brought a load out of Canada, brought it through New York Customs, he says, where are you going? I says, going to Reading, Pennsylvania. He says, well, it's Reading.
Yeah,
I'm sure you run into that all the time.
He says, you might want to say it the correct way, otherwise they'll think you're from out of town. I says, you just looked at a license from Michigan, you're looking at the side of a truck from Ohio, and you're looking at a freight bill from Canada. What's not from out of town?
Lauren, you did mention that you had taken physics. Was that in high school or college?
No, in high school.
And was it the fact that you took physics that led you to understand why diet colas float and why regulars do not?
No, I think it was the common sense everyday version of physics that my dad had from 12th grade education. He was born in 1924, was in World War II, 12th grade education, but it was applied physics. So it was more pertinent to everyday life. I tend to think the stuff that they get in school from books is they don't apply it so well. I think that's one of the things you see. So it doesn't relate. So what's the point?
That's my whole mission here is to teach physics that's useful. If it's not useful, first off, it's not going to stick. The students, by and large, won't even get it the first go around, and they certainly won't retain it after the semester's over. So I try to hang all the physics I teach under real-life objects. It's sort of case study. So talking about floating cans of soda makes it relevant to real life. You encounter this pretty often, this kind of sort of physics in your hand.
Lauren, you may have heard early on Dr. Bloomfield mention something that I certainly identify with, and that is that for many people, trying to get through a physics course is like a hazing ritual. Was that your experience, or did you really enjoy it?
No, I enjoyed it.
It depends so much on how it's presented and who's teaching it. So there are some fantastic high school physics teachers around who make it relevant, get the students engaged, focus on things that are relevant and important and that will stick with the students. But then there are curricula that are sort of stiff, rigid, and academic. A lot of calculating, not much application to real life. That's not so good.
Lauren, thank you so very much for your call. Our guest, Lou Bloomfield's book is titled How Everything Works, Making Physics Out of the Ordinary. And Lou, we actually posted this morning on our Facebook page a picture of the cover of your book, and that prompted Skyler apparently to respond. He has this post on our Facebook page, says, "Can the book be summed up in a paragraph? Somehow I think Newton's laws will probably be mentioned."
What I've tried to do in that book is to go through most of the physics you will ever encounter in your life. That is, going from just simple inertia, as I talked about with the roller coaster, to things like medical x-rays and diagnostic tools. So to cover all that physics, but always in objects. So I start off with Newton's laws, but in objects of that you experience, like a seesaw or bumper cars. And then wander through other parts of physics, always in context. The world of air, and I'm making this more than a paragraph, but I hope Skyler will forgive me. You can pretend it's a paragraph; it's just run on, and it has an aside shoehorned in the middle. Balls and air. If you go to look at all the ball sports, the interactions between the balls and the air are fantastic. Everything from curveballs in baseball to the long flying character of a golf ball after you hit it, it's all full of physics. So I wander the world in a methodical manner. It's not just willy nilly to show you all the physics in the everyday things.
Talk to us about MOOCs. Massively open online course.
Yeah, they've been around now for something maybe 2 years. It's very recent. In any case, the University of Virginia decided to join in this rage, this craze. It's neither a rage or a craze. It's a new adventure, and what it is basically the current most evolved version of an online class. And it's massive in that the enrollments can be nearly astronomical. It's open in that it costs nothing to enroll, and it's online. It comes over the web. And so, in general, these classes then consist of some number of weeks of coursework material that's largely video of some form or other, and homework assignments, and maybe some other odds and ends. And people can just sign up from anywhere in the world and take them for free, which is pretty cool. And I was one of the initial volunteers to do this at the university, and I taught How Things Work, which is the course I've taught at the university for 20 years. I taught an initial portion of it it depends on how you count them, to several tens of thousands of students.
But you did not just stand in front of a lectern and let yourself be videotaped talking about this stuff.
No. My classroom is a live experience. It's a shared experience, the actual live class. Questions come in. It's a conversation. When I'm doing my best, when I'm on my game, it is a conversation. And the class can pivot at any moment based on what someone brings up in the audience, the students. So that experience I can't convey online. What I can convey online is the content presented as carefully and filmed as well as I possibly can do. And so I built basically science television. I did it pretty much by myself. And I did it the way I've done a fair amount of science television at this point. And I
used to host a show on the Discovery Channel.
That's right. So I made this the way I would have done that. The difference is that it's a crew of one. So I did everything, which makes it a huge amount of work. But it gives me tremendous control, and that's important actually in science television. Science television typically is not done by scientists. Maybe there's one or two around, but it's pretty much done by people who do media. And it's amazingly easy to damage the content in the editing suite or scripted voiceover, any which way you could damage it. So I enjoyed having the control to do it right.
That's what was so interesting to me, Lou Bloomfield, is that unlike any number of faculty members at universities across the country who are unhappy with the idea of online teaching, you have embraced it and you talk about the joy of doing it. I want to ask you more about that, but we now have some people who've been on hold here for a bit, so let's get to some of these calls first. Next to Harrisonburg, Peter, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment for physicist Lou Bloomfield, please.
Hi, Dr. Bloomfield. Yes, my name is Peter, and I just wanted to express my appreciation for having taken physics at a Blue Ridge Community College course. The instructor there was teaching instrumentation for an electrician training program that I was in, and through that I asked him if he taught it in the evening because I wanted to take it after I started working. Did so, and what was particularly special about him was the earlier caller talked about applied physics. He involved it in what was there around us. And the other thing was he was a magnificent storyteller. So I remember learning about Newtonian physics and shooting a projectile, and he by him telling the story of how in ancient times gunpowder was made. And how long it took to gather up the ingredients for making gunpowder. So every shot was precious, so that learning how to aim it was important. Just a magnificent instructor, and it led me to gain a great understanding of gases and phase change, which led me to getting a job in refrigeration years later.
Yeah, it's amazing what having a good teacher will do, somebody who can make, who can relate to you. Physics, I think, is probably one of the worst offenders in academia in terms of people not relating well, the instructors not relating well with their students. And I don't really mean to diss the physics teacher so much as it's their mind, the way most physicists think, they forget how difficult it was for them to learn some of what they're teaching. They're too far away from that moment of first learning it, and they have forgotten how hard it was, and they don't therefore relate very well to a lot of their audience.
Peter, thank you so very much for your call. Physicist Lou Bloomfield is our guest. His textbook for college students is titled How Things Work, The Physics of Everyday Life. His book for the general public is titled How Everything Works, Making Physics Out of the Ordinary. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. If you'd like to speak with our guest, we have a couple of phone lines open at 888-967-2825. Another call coming in from Harrisonburg. Jennifer, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is, I actually took How Things Work course online many years ago, and I was fascinated to find out how tube televisions work, but now they're all flat screen. So I was wondering if Dr. Bloomfield could give a quick synopsis now to bring me up to the next century.
Oh, yeah. You're bringing up an issue that I deal with all the time, the evolution of technology. Physics itself, the physics that most of us teach in any physics, introductory physics course, doesn't change very much for decades at a time. But I find that my course has to keep changing, not because the physics is changing or they're learning new things, but because the objects of everyday life are changing. One of my favorite topics was television sets. I taught it 20 years ago, and I finally had to pull the plug on it, I don't know, maybe 8 years ago, when tube television sets just became dodo birds. Yeah. So flat screens. These are all based. They're based in part on a new light source. The light source is typically light emitting diodes. Some of them were compact fluorescents. So part of the physics would be how light is created by those diodes, and it has to do with essentially little atomic structures that live inside a piece of solid that are excited electronically by electricity. The flow of electric current through this structure puts electrons in the equivalent of an atom with more energy than they started with, and in the process of giving up that energy to go back to where they started with, they give off particles of light, what are called photons, and ultimately those photons are what you see with your eye. Now those photons. Those little light quanta, they also call them, have colors associated with them, and there's that's I could get into that story, but I'm going to skip it for the moment just to be quick here. But controlling where you see that light, the greens and the blues and the reds, I have to remember the primary colors of light, which is itself another story. Controlling where you see that is done by an electric effect that manipulates little molecules of liquid known as liquid crystal. These little molecules are liquid crystals in that they have a lot of order in them. They tend to line up with one another the way the atoms and molecules line up in a crystal, like you see a beautiful quartz crystal, say in nature. A liquid crystal means they line up, but they can still flow. They're actually they are a liquid, not a solid. But electricity can cause those crystals, those lined up molecules, to shift around and reorient, and they affect the passage of light through them in a way, in this case, that can wink on or off the light. So it, basically, then the flat screen television starts with a source of light, which is these LEDs. Light-emitting diodes, and it has a very complicated surface with lots of little pixels, tiny spots, that can wink on or off the passage of light by manipulating crystals.
Jennifer, that was a wonderful question because it certainly elicited a wonderful answer. Thank you so much for thinking it up.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for asking.
The book is titled How Everything Works. Its author, physicist Lou Bloomfield, is our guest, and our conversation is going to continue in just a bit more than 1 minute. Once again, the group They Might Be Giants with their song, this time Speed and Velocity. Lou Bloomfield, author, inventor, educator, education reformer, and professor of physics at the University of Virginia, is our guest. So to you who are listening, many people who discovered a favorite subject in school say it was actually a favorite teacher who led them there. So I'm curious, if you did take an interest in science, was there a special instructor involved? Would you be willing to tell us what made that teacher special? Phone lines available at 888-WMRA-TALK. And Missy in Farmville, thanks for using that number and calling in your question or comment for Dr. Bloomfield, please.
Yes, hi, Dr. Bloomfield. This is Missy, and I actually went to high school with you in Urbana, Illinois, and knew your sister, and have been over at your house a lot.
Missy Lanford?
Yes, yes, good memory, wow.
I know you. Hey, that's cool.
Yeah, so we actually don't even live that far away, but I am very excited to hear about this, and I am also real interested in your inventions. And I wonder if any of them, if you could tell us about some of them, and if any of them are non-physics related.
Well, the invention that that Tom mentioned at the top of the hour is a material that I've come up with, which I'm calling VSTIC, for, short for viscoelastic silicone rubber. And the I'll give you the reason why I invented it first. It really was to solve the rocking table problem. If you've got a gap underneath the fourth leg of a table, it'll teeter back and forth between the between three legs. And so I wanted something you could shove underneath at least one of the legs, maybe all the legs, that would always fill a gap and then be very stiff when you bang the table so it won't rock. And I started off total amateur. I was going to use silly putty and some springy container for it. So the springy container would make sure that the stuff fills the gap, and the silly putty is stiff when you poke at it. So it was going to do the job. And it's a long story, but I eventually evolved from the silly putty being I'm giving you the whole story, but not the whole story. But it evolved from being a big blob of silly putty in a sort of a single springy container to being tiny droplets of silly putty in a springy material to eventually being just one material that is simultaneously stiff when you bump it and soft and compliant but also springy when you're patient. So I have, you know, it's radio, so you can see this beautiful orange ball that I have in front of me, and now Tom has. It's
I'm gonna bang it against the microphone here, see if you can. You can't see it, but it's a beautiful color orange, and it's what, less than an inch?
It's almost exactly an inch, the way I made the mold for it. So it's like a bouncy ball. So picture an orange bouncy ball. You can't tell a difference if you just look at it. It bounces like a bouncy ball, everything. What's different is if you squeeze it patiently, you can deform it like chewing gum. You can stretch it out. I mean, it depends on how I formulate it, but you could stretch it out until it's 4 inches long.
And I'm squeezing it and pressing it now.
Yeah, so Tom's taking it all out of round.
Yeah.
And if you drop it while it's out of round, it bounces all crazy because it's not, you know, balls are meant to be round.
So this did answer the problem of the annoying three-legged table out of balance at a restaurant. But it also turns out that you found that this has lots and lots of other possible uses.
Yeah. Somewhere down the line, I'll eventually get to dealing with rocking tables. It's way more useful for other things like human padding, just shoe insoles, prosthetics and orthotics, hearing aid, ear inserts, cane handles, shoulder straps. So we're in the midst of trying to get this commercialized, licensed out, and people to actually make this and put it out in the real world. And I think finally that it's going to have much more impact on the world than my 25 odd years of basic scientific research.
Missy, we're at the studio of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities in Charlottesville today. So I don't have my usual staff colleagues with me. But I'm hoping that I can find somebody here who's got a camera so that they'll take a picture of this little orange ball and we'll post it on our Facebook page by tomorrow morning so that people can see just how simple this looks. But you've heard how wonderful it could possibly be.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for your call.
Versatile. Okay, thanks. And I noticed you got a haircut since high school.
I did, and you missed the period when I had a beard too. So that came and went. It's been a while.
Okay. All right, good to talk to you.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you.
The number to call if you'd like to join a discussion here on Virginia Insight, 888-WMRA Talk. Got a question about how physics plays a role in your everyday world? Some thoughts on how science education can be improved? 888-967 2825, or if you prefer to post to us on Facebook, we're listed there as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Next, we're going to Waynesboro. Yvonne, thanks for joining us. Your
Hi.
Question or comment, please. Hi.
Hi, thank you. I just had a quick comment. I'm really, really enjoying the show, and I just noticed you mentioned the Foundation for the Humanities. I'm currently at an apprentice at a cobbler shop in Waynesboro, and so we're big in with the humanities folks. That's really cool. And also with your substances, the polymers and the under the table substance. I really like the idea of that, of something that could be used in footwear. But the main reason I called in is because I just wanted to mention a science teacher in high school that affected me greatly and really opened me up to the world of physics. His name was Ken Patterson. It's Juris Draft. I think he's since retired, but a few years later, I ended up actually getting a tattoo on my leg of his explanation of entropy. And
yeah,
that's my whole comment.
Can you tell us what the explanation was?
The way that he explained it, he stood up on a chair, and then he got up on a desk, and he dropped a glass mason jar on the ground. And it was explaining going from a low entropy state to a high entropy state. And so I ended up getting a tattoo of a broken mason jar with entropy mixed in there.
That's great. That is essentially the same as it's one of my demonstrations of entropy. And I think it might even be in the book, a picture of breaking a glass in this case, is the world, our world, tends to increase in disorder. You never shake up your sock drawer and discover that all the socks have miraculously paired themselves up. It always gets the other way. And that's
right.
It's just a statistical problem. It's not Newton's laws. It's the laws of probability that if you let things go to disorder, they will. And they will not reorder because it's too unlikely, like winning the lottery a bunch of times in a row. And so when you drop a mason jar on the ground and smash it, the jar is still all there. The energy and everything's still all there. In principle, if you took that mason jar back up the ladder and dropped it a second time, the smashed mason jar, it could reassemble itself. It could go back exactly as it did the first time. But in practice, it never happens. It's too unlikely. And that's the drift of our universe towards more and more disorder.
Yvonne, thank you so very much for your call.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
The book is titled How Everything Works, Making Physics Out of the Ordinary. Its author, physicist Lou Bloomfield, is our guest. Okay, let me be a smart aleck. Elliot Majerzik across the hallway here was helping us set up the studio a little earlier today. Heard that you were going to be here, that the main title of your book was How Everything Works, and he wanted to know if you can explain marriage.
Alas, no. I think it was Newton's fourth law, but it got edited out of the Principia.
Well, let's go back to talking about online teaching, which you love, but lots of other teachers don't. What do you see as the difference? Why do you love it?
I'm not averse to change. I actually kind of like change. So I'm always seeking out whatever's on the horizon. And I think higher education or education in general is going to change. Disruptive technology is disruptive. It has revolutionized, for better or worse, say the music industry, television, the three networks there used to be, or maybe four, not so much anymore. And it's going to happen to higher education. And you either recognize that it's going to happen, or you drag in your heels and fight it. It's not going to work. It's going to happen. So how it settles out, who knows? But I'm having fun participating in the change.
Lou, you've mentioned fear as a block to learning earlier in the hour, and even before we turned the microphones on today, you and I were both talking about how we've all each had experiences of seeing where fear was a block, not just in science, but in other subjects where people felt that they might look dumb if they tried something that they didn't feel confident they knew how to do well. With that in mind, if you were to teach teachers to be better teachers, what would you tell them? And would it have anything to do with the fact that maybe their students have some fear that's not obvious?
Yeah, something about what you just said makes me, it's a little bit of revelation for me. It's that the students don't fear the science. They fear the process, the environment, the worry about feeling dumb. The science itself isn't really the object of the fear. And so probably if a teacher of science can get rid of this environment, the fearful environment, the science will just come naturally. Now, of course, they also need to present the science in a way that's palatable or better, or at least palatable. But many of the it's human nature for some teachers to do things like stroke their own ego by intimidating and or blowing away the students. There's no value to that. It serves no purpose. I mean, it doesn't really boost the ego of the teacher. It more just diminishes life in the classroom. So get the ego out the door. Realize your students actually want to make good use of the time if you give them the opportunity. So give them the opportunity. Reach out to them. I mean, if they're hostile, finally, what can you do? But go as far as you can to them rather than making them come as far as possible to you, or at least meet halfway. Teach them what they want to learn, not necessarily what you want to teach them.
Physicist Lou Bloomfield, as much as you love teaching, you have done a lot of research. We've talked a little bit about it during this hour. We haven't mentioned that some of your early research actually was on something that came to be known as carbon 60. Eventually, that particular substance and a gentleman named Rick Smalley, who made some discoveries in that area, would lead to a Nobel Prize for Dr. Smalley. So your research has, in many areas, has not been insignificant. But I have this quote from you, Lou, that I want to ask you about. You have said in the past, quote, "The teaching that I have done has had more influence on the world than the basic research I will ever do."
Yeah, I think that's right. That it's hard to do something in basic research that really changes life. If research, in my view, if research doesn't change how people think and what they do, it's questionable whether it was worth doing. So there's a lot of research that's done that doesn't change how people think and doesn't change what they do. And that's a little bit, that could be fun and games for scientists. So I tried to make a difference whenever I was working, doing basic research. I tried to do things that really did change how people think. But I didn't succeed in really changing how people live until maybe now. So one of the things I find particularly valuable about this new material that I've come up with is I think this actually will change people's lives. That for example, as a liner for prosthetics or orthotics, that it will make for a more comfortable artificial limb, for example. So it actually will make the world a better place. Directly, rather than sort of by very indirect meandering means. And my teaching, I think, has had that effect for 20 years, that I actually do send people out in the world having worked with me on trying to learn how the world works. I think I send them out in the world a little more capable of making a good go of it. And that makes me happy.
We've got 30 seconds left. In half a minute, what else can you tell us about how the world works that most of us probably don't realize?
The microwave oven. It's really cooking with microwaves, with radio waves. And radio waves have electric aspect to them. And when they talk about not putting metal in the microwave, it's because you don't really want electric currents and sparks shooting out of the metal items cooked by a microwave oven. It's a lot of fun. I show that in my class. It's okay. A lot of fun.
Does that also mean that you should not put your head really close to the radio?
Oh, amazingly enough, all the radio waves from cell phones and stuff, there's no evidence that it causes any injury at all.
Our guest has been Lou Bloomfield, author of How Everything Works, Making Physics Out of the Ordinary, as well as a professor of physics at the University of Virginia. Lou, thank you so very much for making time for us.
Hey, it's been fun, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Virginia Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers, Bob Levicky and Terry Ward. We had extra help today from Sarah McConnell, Andrew Windham, and Elliot Majerzik at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And when you go to that page, you will find links to more information about the work that Dr. Bloomfield is doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.